I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey folks, this is Kevin. Just a few words before we start. Live show's coming up on April 14th and 15th. Risk is at the Bridgetown Comedy Festival in Portland, Oregon. We're going to have Maria Bamford, Eric Andre, Sean Patton, Baron Vaughn, and many more. So come on out to see us in Portland on April 14th and 15th. Now, over at thestorystudio.org, Mr. David Crabb is offering a two-day workshop on storytelling with characters on April 21st and 22nd. It's about bringing the people in your stories to life in your performance. David's teaching skills were the subject of a glowing article in the New York Times this month. We're very proud of him. And we're always adding 2 days and 9 week workshops at thestorystudio.org. Finally, don't forget the most affordable and reliable place to get your sex toys, lube, condoms, lingerie, adult DVDs. It's the deal that Risk fans rave about. It's the place I get most of my supplies. It's adamandeve.com. You go there, you type in the offer code RISK at the checkout. You get 50% off just about any item, 3 free adult DVDs, free shipping, and an extra surprise. AdamandEve.com, and the offer code is RISK. Now here's the show.
May I have your attention, please?
Kids, this is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison. This is the Harry Brewer Orchestra behind me now. And this is Penises and Buttholes.
Penises and buttholes, penises and buttholes, penises and butts.
Yeah, my friend JC wrote the lyrics to that one. Quite concise, but boy do I love that imagery. Today's episode is called Your Attention, Please. And that's because all the stories in it somehow logically fit in a program titled Your Attention, Please. These are all live stories today. All stories from our live shows in New York and Los Angeles. We're going to start with a hero of mine, someone who was a real inspiration for this very show's existence. This is Margot Lightman. She is the host of the fantabulous show. Why did I say that? Stripped Stories. And you can find her at margolightman.com. Here's Margot at our show in Los Angeles. We call this one Almost Famous.
Hello. All right, so I'm going to tell a story about fourth grade. Fourth grade, I was in a musical group called the Jersey Girls, thank you, because we were from New Jersey and girls. And the group was basically, it was two people, me and this girl, Amanda. And I really needed Amanda in my group because unlike me, who was 5'6" in fourth grade and like an unattractive thin, do you know what I mean? When a girl is skinny, but it's gross, like olive oil or Mackenzie Phillips, like that. And my mom, I just wasn't cool. Like, my mom made me homemade jams. It was just not. So I needed Amanda because she was very normal size. She was very tan. She was very pretty. And she could basically sing good enough. Unlike me, I couldn't sing at all. But I was the brains and the business behind the duo. I did all the work. I was essentially Simon to her Garfunkel. Like, I needed her because she was a little bit more attractive and she could sing better. But, like, in the end, I was going to have a better career. So, I wrote all the songs, including our two sleeper hits, which were In Love With a Star, which was written about growing pains, Kirk Cameron, and our other sleeper hit, I Don't Even Know What Love Is, which kind of counteracted the meaning of In Love With a Star. And we used to go to her house every day after school and practice our songs and record them on our Fisher-Price tape recorder in her bedroom. And this was a routine about 5 days a week every day. And I was like, you know what? Like, my clock is ticking. Debbie Gibson is 15. And she is touring the country wearing funky hats. She is a millionaire. Like, my time is coming. So let's go. Let's make a business plan. Let's move forward here. You know, let's get out of the bedroom. So I'm starting to get antsy. So I leave Amanda's house one day and I'm like, I'm going to write a big hit for us, a big hit that's going to take us to the next level. So I go into my bedroom and I hit the Mead notebook paper and I start writing. And I write a song that I have to say I think was really good. Like, the lyrics were really, really good. But the problem is that I had virtually zero musical talent, so I didn't have any melody. So then, a stroke of genius, I decide that I'm going to steal the melody from Wham's Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go, and I'm just gonna set my lyrics to it and hope that nobody notices. So I'll sing you the song now. It went, and I'd be thinking of you, oh, I just can't bear it, but I know it's true. And you'd be thinking of me, oh, I know it, I can't see. And we'd be singing this same song, oh, I know it, but I wish I wasn't wrong. Listen, boy, and listen well, I don't want them to know, so don't tell. Wake me up before you go-go. I mean, it was Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go. It just was different lyrics. And I was like, I'm amazing. That song came out like 3 years ago. Nobody will ever remember it. I'm going to be famous. So I bring it to her in school the next day. And I'm like, check it out. I sing it for her. And she's like, this is amazing. And I don't know if she knew I stole it or not. I also think she didn't care. So she's like, we have to take it to Mr. Fervor. He's got a lot of really big time connections in the music industry. And Mr. Fervor was our band teacher, who seemed continuously disappointed in my life choices, because that year, it was only like second month of school, I had gone from flute to clarinet to sitting out in band. So I really needed to impress him. So we go to Mr. Fervor and we sing the song for him, and he was like, wow, girls, that's amazing, you wrote that? And we were both nodding furiously, and I'm looking at her like, well, I'm really anxious to take credit for a song that I have both stolen and slaved over. But she takes credit for it, which is fine, because I'm going to drop her when I get famous. And so he goes, well, you know, I'm going to work on the piano accompaniment for this. I have an idea, girls. Why don't you practice this, and we'll put it up in the school and town assembly. And I was like, okay, this is what I'm looking for. Because in my head, that was where the big time agents were gonna come, and I was gonna get discovered, I was gonna get a record deal, somebody would fly in and see me, and somebody would freaking notice me, finally. So I'm so excited about this. And as we're walking out, he was like, girls, you know, you might wanna look into copywriting this bad boy. You know, a song this good could get stolen. And we walked out, and I was like, that's a good idea. I went home from school, I discussed it with my mother, And my mother and I, over the next week, she helped me copyright with the U.S. Bureau of Copyright a song I had stolen from Wham. And I copyrighted Wake Me Up Before You Go Go as my own legally, and I'm in fourth grade. And so I have like documentation. I also cut Amanda out of it. I kept cutting her out. I was a horrible business partner. And I copyrighted it as my own. And my mother helped me. And so it started to get closer and closer to the assembly. And I start entertaining the thought of the two greatest possible scenarios that are going to happen, which is one, I'm going to do it in the assembly. There's going to be a big music mogul in the audience. They're going to discover me. They're going to say, you know, you're going to be the next Debbie Gibson. She's too old. You're going to be a star. Cut out Amanda. I've noticed you. There's something special about you. You've got talent. And option two was an equally appealing scenario, which was getting caught. Oh my God. Because if I got caught, then everyone would notice me, and everyone would care, and everyone would be talking, and maybe I'd be on the front page of the newspaper of like, scandal, cheater, liar, thief. And for some reason, that attention was equally fabulous to me. So it was a win-win. Everyone would know who I am. Either way, my life is about to change. And so we go in to sing the song, and Mr. Fervor is accompanying us, and he's like, please welcome the Jersey Girls. And we come out to minor applause, and he starts playing furiously, like Elton John in the 70s. I mean, it was amazing. He was playing with such heart. And so Amanda and I start doing it, and I remember the routine. It was step, touch, sway, repeat. Step, touch. So we're singing this song and doing like, don't want them to know. I mean, what's in the Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go? That dance routine. I swear it was the same dance routine. So we're just doing the same thing. And I'm like waiting for the uproarious applause. And as it's over, it's just for the school. And the school kind of moderately claps. Nobody seems to care. And I'm like, well, they're jealous. They're obviously jealous of my talent. And the other thing that's going on here is that this is peanuts. I mean, this is daytime. I have a nighttime performance for the town. This is where it's going to happen. This is practice. Don't worry about it. So that night, I'm getting ready in my room for the big town assembly, and I'm so excited. I put on my best outfit, my matching peach sweatsuit. I'm ready to go. And I come downstairs, ready for the assembly, and my father's watching the game, and my mom's like, what are you doing? I'm like, the assembly, I'm singing my hit tonight. I'm singing Thinking of You. Don't you remember? And my mother's like, oh yeah. My dad's like, well, there's a game on. So my dad's not even coming. And I'm like, well, where's my brother? And they're like, we don't know. Like, he's not coming. Nobody's coming. And I have to fight with my mother to even come. Like, nobody cares. And so my mom's like, all right, I'll go. I'll take you. So she takes me to the assembly, and I'm ready, and I'm backstage, and I'm like, your life is about to change. You're going to be like the biggest villain or the biggest star, but from this day forward, you're not going to be invisible anymore. Someone is going to pay attention to you. It's going to be amazing. And I'm backstage, and I'm so excited. And they go, please welcome the Jersey Girls. Again, very moderate applause. And we come out, step, touch, sway, repeat, step, touch, sway, repeat. And we sing the whole song. And I know that somebody out there is going to discover me. And then it ends. And I'm ready for option one, which is uproarious applause and someone for Stan to stand up in the audience, like in that scene in Back to the Future where they're like, hey, this is a new sound we've been looking for. And I'm waiting for that moment, but still kind of moderate applause. And then I'm waiting for someone else, like the Wild West, to stand up and be like, cheater, liar, and then that doesn't happen. And then I look, and then I'm trying to find my mother out in the audience, because my mother cried. I mean, she cried at every greeting card I've ever given her, everything. And I look out into the audience, and my mother, who had previously, the day before, cried in an episode of Laverne and Shirley, I look out and I see her dry eyes, sort of just clapping moderately, and everyone is sort of just politely clapping. There was a third option that I didn't think could happen, which is that no one would care. I mean, no one cared that I wrote the song, no one cared that I stole the song, no one wanted to make me famous, no one cared that I was cheating my way to the top, no one cared that I legally copyrighted a song written by George Michael. No one was impressed, and no one cared. And it was the most devastating feeling. And then after the show, my mom was like, hey, good job, I guess. I mean, great job. Do you want to go to Friendly's? And I was like, we always go to Friendly's. Like, I thought that night I would be going to Sardi's or something amazing. And so she takes me to Friendly's, and I'm sitting in this Friendly in Blue Collar, New Jersey, where I grew up, and The waitress comes over who's been working there for 20 years, who has like 8 foster kids, and she comes over and she's talking to us about her kids, and I'm thinking, is this what my life's gonna be like? It's never gonna get any better than this. And my mother orders me the usual, the clown sundae, which really isn't a clown, it's just an upside down ice cream cone, which occurred to me that night. And I'm eating this and it's so sad, and we pull in, and she and my mom just goes, as we pull into the driveway, good job. And we walk in and my life stayed exactly the same. And then about a year ago, I was thinking about the story and writing about it, and I was like, you know what? I'm gonna tell my mom. I'm gonna tell my mom I stole it because she was an accomplice to copywriting this song. I'm gonna tell her, I'm gonna come clean. So I'm on the phone with her. I go, Mom, remember in fourth grade when I wrote that song and I copyrighted it and I sang it in the school assembly? And my mom's like, what? Sort of, vaguely. And I was like, well, I want you to know that I stole it, Mom. I stole it from Wham. It was just Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go. I'm so sorry. I've kept it in all these years, but I stole the song. My mom goes, Margo, I don't care. And then she finishes it off with, she goes, Margo, no one cares. Thank you.
Been thinking of you, oh, I just can't bear it, but I know it's true. And you've been thinking of me, oh, I know what I know it, I can't see. And we've been singing this same song, oh, I know what I know it, but I wish I was wrong. Listen more and listen well, I don't want them to know, so don't tell.
I've been caught stealing once when I was 5. Just the alien, just as simple as that.
This is Risk. We put the boom boom into your heart, do we not? All right, next up we're going to do two stories in a row. Second one's going to come from our beloved David Crabb, who is a teacher at the Story Studio. And the first one's going to come from me. This will be the first time that I feature a story on the show that is actually from the family vaults. A story that is often retold by various storytellers within my family. One of those kind of tales. Speaking of tales, remember this?
Penises and buttholes, penises and buttholes, penises and buttholes.
Great times back on hosting segment one. Just listen to that. Hosting segment two has been like a funeral in comparison. Now that I think of it, it's unnerving how superior hosting segment one was. Hosting segment two. But let's just put you out of our misery already. It's time to just cut our losses and get the fuck out of this. Not as much fun as the last one. Hosting segment. So here I am at the Risk Show in New York with a story we call The Exhibitionist. And I think we can all just breathe a sigh of relief now. That is the end of hosting segment two. You know, every family has a bunch of stories that they break out every time they're all together, right? They tell them and they retell them, and everyone's got different versions. They disagree about the details. And this is one that comes from my clan. I come from a long line of assless men. My father, his father, his brothers, their sons, my brothers. If you look at my backside, you will see that I don't so much have a ballast there as what I prefer to call a lack thereof. And I used to be rather concerned about this. But one year when I was in high school, my mother and my father and I, we went to Edisto, South Carolina, which is a place that is, it's very rare that you still find these places in America where there's actually more locals there than there are tourists. You know, it's still very quiet, and it's very, very, very southern. People are very salt of the earth there. So once we arrived in Edisto, it's about 1988, I'm about 18 years old, we were starving. So we wanted to go to a restaurant right off the beach, and we got in there and we were like, oh my God, everyone had the same idea today, because the place was packed. So the hostess kind of wedges us into the middle of this completely packed restaurant. Now my father is a very fat man. And he always has been, you know. He loves his beer. He loves the fat on the edges of the steak more than the steak. And people always think of him as kind of being a little bit like Santa Claus, only with a red beard. So we wedge in there, and he's just kind of, you know, getting it, because he's right behind him. There's this little girl, about a 12-year-old girl, in a wheelchair. So he's kind of bumping up against her and wedging down into a seat. And then as soon as we're seated, Dad has to stand up again. He's like, oh, God damn it, I just have to get this sweatshirt off. So he wedges himself back up and hits the girl in the wheelchair again. And he starts trying to get this sweatshirt off. Well, it was too tight on him with his big bulbous belly, and he starts yanking around at it. And as he starts this process, I begin to notice that he's taking the white undershirt that's underneath the sweatshirt up along with the sweatshirt, right? So my mom starts going, Paul, and he's just like, God, shut up, Carol, I'm just gonna take this sweatshirt off. And he's pulling it up, and more of his belly is being exposed. And then many things happened within the next few seconds. He's pulling and pulling, and finally he does manage to get it up around his face, but it gets stuck there. Now he's kind of blindfolded himself, and he's managed to kind of tangle his arms above his head too. So his belly is sticking out there in the middle of the restaurant for everyone to see, and he just starts like thrashing around like some sort of alien monster with tentacles at everyone. And everyone's looking like, what on earth is going on? And with all the thrashing and wriggling, my dad must have temporarily forgot that a belt is not very useful for an assless man. In our case, you really are only safe with suspenders. But Dad always hated suspenders. So while he's wriggling around and my mom's like, Paul, and he's like, God damn it, Kara, I just gotta get this off. His shorts hit the ground. And he's got these old, old fruit of the loom tidy whities. They're all stretched out and full of holes. So he's standing there in the middle of the restaurant, like blindfolded, wearing nothing now but his shoes and his underwear, and everyone's looking. And the man, there's a man at the table with the girl in the wheelchair. Now, this guy was pure southern, like hardcore, like not a very chipper guy, right? He just jumps up and he's like, what the hell is going on here? Now, in fairness, it did appear that my dad was starting a dominant and submissive scene right there in the middle of lunch. But my mom and I jump up, we're like, this is an accident, it's an accident. And my dad starts to realize what's going on, and he just quickly, I've never seen him move so quickly as this, gets his shorts up and his shirt back down, and he wedges himself back into his seat. And then all three of us just kind of start staring at our plates, like we're gonna learn something there. And we realized that the man behind us was still standing, still making sure that this is really and truly over, and then he sits down. And it was just clear that no one in the restaurant thought that this was at all funny, which is why the three of us thought it was hilarious. We spend like the next half hour just in tears, our stomachs hurting because we're trying to stifle this laughter for the longest time because we know it's annoying the people around us, but we just couldn't help it. So it gives me a special satisfaction to tell this story tonight because, you know, my mom, she has a version of this story. And my dad, he has a version of this story, and I always have to defend my version. But of the three of us, I'm the one with a podcast. Thank you.
A few years ago, I had just lost my job as a bartender, and it was kind of the last straw for me. I had had many endeavors that I started in my 20s and early 30s that went unfulfilled. I was a photographer for a while, but I became sick of the isolation and the chemicals. I was an actor, but I got sick of begging for approval as a profession. And then I was an electronic musician, but I decided that I hated my computer, which just was the death knell if you're looking to be the next Daft Punk. It's just never going to happen. So when I lost this job, it sucked, because like having failed ambitions is one thing, but not making money to survive is another. I went home, and my boyfriend was totally being supportive, and he's like, you know, just get on Craigslist and look around. You can find something to do. So I would get on Craigslist, and I would search, but in like 30 minutes, I'd get really bored, and I would just end up in that disgusting anything goes section where there was like people that want you to come and smell their farts. Awful things. And I just sort of felt rudderless and lost. About a week and a half into this, we lived in this huge four-story house that we shared with some people in Williamsburg right by the East River. And my boyfriend comes from upstairs, and he says, David, there's something horrid in the basement. And I say, okay. So we go down to our basement, and our basement is like one of these unfinished basements. It's like a dirt floor and these waterlogged rafters. It looks like where you would wake up at the beginning of like a Saw movie. And I look in the middle of this dirt floor, and there is this black dot. It's so matte, it almost looks like negative space, like it's like a hole you could reach through in the space-time continuum. And as I look at this black dot, all of a sudden this tiny green eye opens, and then this horrible dry pink mouth opens, and it lets out this... As I realize this thing is a fucked up kitten, it opens its other eye, and you know how cats have that inner lid that's kind of white? It doesn't open, so it just has this disgusting white, like, milk eye in one eye. And it goes to hiss again, and then it, like, out from the circle of its body, this one terrifying paw reaches out, and it starts to claw itself away from us, the whole time looking back going... It was disgusting and terrifying, and on top of all that, I'm totally allergic to cats. Like, nosebleeds, rashes in my beard, like the worst, right? So we don't know what to do, so we wrap this little kitten in a towel, and we borrow a crate from a friend, and we like throw the whole ball in there, like, good luck, kitten. We take it upstairs, and we lock the cage, and over the next few days, we kind of hang out with this weird black cat. I'm at home a lot, and I start to sort of like the cat, and... spend more time with the cat, and I spend less time on Craigslist because the cat needs a lot of things. The cat needs to be pet often, much like babies need skin-to-skin contact. Little deformed kittens, they need to be pet. And then I realize it needs to be fed milk through a dropper, but it really likes heavy cream, so I switch over to that. And then, because it can't get away from its poop, because it's crippled and can't walk, it needs bath. I gave the cat like 7 baths a day in a warm water in the sink, and then I would put it, and then it couldn't just be wet, so then I had to get the hair dryer, but I would put the little diffuser attachment on, and then I would blow dry the cat, and it would just go with its weird gimpai and its weird one working like the fan blowing on it. It was like a kitten spa, really, is what I was setting up in my house. So we take this kitten to the vet, and the vet looks at it and says, I'm really sorry to tell you this, but this cat has lateral threading in its eye, and that means that it basically has right side paralysis. It's right eye, right leg, right, both legs. They're never going to work. If you want to try, kittens can bounce back. Give it a go. And boy, did I. I was like the miracle worker. This was like my Helen Keller, my little feline problem to solve. So we take the cat home, and we tell our housemate, oh my God, you have to come see the kitten. And he's very nonchalant about everything. And he looks at the kitten, and he says, oh my God, it looks like the puppet from Eraserhead. But it was beautiful to me. So we had this Oscar party. We'd had the cat now about 4 weeks, and I was very excited for all our friends to come over because no one had seen me, because all I did was stay at home depressed with no job helping this cat. So they came over, and it was so disturbing because over and over again, this is what would happen. There was a sheet over her crate, and as someone would come up, I'd be like, Jennifer, come here. And then I'd lift the sheet, and they would go, oh my God. Over and over again. It was like I had the ugliest baby in the world. I was lifting the hood of my stroller. It's, oh, God, cover that thing. So we took the kitten back to the vet, and she said, look, this is not going well. I don't think this kitten's ever going to walk, and I think you should put her down before you get any more attached. I said, no, we're going to make this work. We're going to make it work. So on the way out, the receptionist there said she was this Puerto Rican lady who, she did the thing where she wore the pink lip gloss but with the brown matte lip line around it, like a terrifying puckered anus. It was very weird. And she said, you know, I just heard you talking to the doctor, and I do physical therapy for these, like, Upper East Side bitches who, like, roll over their dog's legs with their Rolls Royces and shit, so then they have to get metal legs, become, like, robot dogs. And, you know, we do physical therapy, and I can probably show you some things. I was like, yes, do that right now. So she takes Mare out of her little cage, and she lays the kitten on her lap, and then she's like, you could pedal her front paws like this, and then you could take her back paws, and then you can do a diagonal. Grab the left front and the back right, and you can just pedal. The whole time she's doing this, the kitten is just laid out on her lap with a dead oracle eye, like glazed over, the tongue hanging out. So I take this cat home and I'm obsessed. Like, I'm going to make the cat better. So I, nonstop, I'm doing the physical therapy. She's getting 10 baths a day. I'm blow drying her. No job. Bank account. My amazing boyfriend, Jack, is like spending now the hundreds, getting to be thousands of dollars on veterinary care over and over these trips. So, you know, I really, really want this cat to be better. And at a certain point, we have to talk to my housemate because I'm going to be away for a while. So I'm like, Shane, can you please make sure the cat's okay? And he's like, and I call him on the phone and he answers and he says, well, I don't know how to tell if she's okay. She looks like she's been smashed by a truck all the time anyway. Okay. Now, at one point, it just gets really bad, and Mare, now by the way, her name is Mare, and I would tell people, oh, Mare, like a little black horse. I was lying. I was in such a low place that I was sitting drunk in my underwear drinking whiskey with her on my lap watching like 10 hours of Battlestar Galactica with a tear in my eye when I literally said out loud to the room of no one, you're like my miracle. That's her name, Miracle. That's what I named a fucking cat at the lowest point in my life, Miracle. I meant mare, like a horse. So at a certain point, I found out that I have to go to Texas to visit my family. So I'm really bummed and to leave the cat, and Jack said, I'm gonna take care of her. And I go home, and like 3 days later, he calls me, and he's like, David, I have some news. I'm like, what? He says, Mare walked. I was like, well, what do you mean she walked? And he's like, she walked. So the next 4 days of my trip, I just can't wait to get home. My mom is trying to make me dinners and have conversations. I'm like, I don't know. I just want to get home to Miracle. I meant Mare, like a horse. So I finally get back home, and I'm like, what did you do? And he's like, well, instead of surrounding her with her food and warm towels in the microwave and coddling her nonstop, I put her food in front of her, and when she reached for it, I pulled it away a little bit, and then I did it the next time a little further. Turns out, eventually, she got hungry enough, the bitch walked. And it was great that she walked, but then the new problem began. You know, she was about 2 months old at this point, and even though she walked, we called her Drunky instead of Mary at this point, because it was just a constant kind of like clumping over on the floor and losing her balance. But the problem is that once she could walk around, she could cover a lot more space. She could lay all over the couch. She could lay all over the bed. She could lay on my pillow. She could get on my clothes. And I became just this explosive snot bomb. I started to have nosebleeds and get welts. And we would wake up every morning and my eyes were like crusted shut. And I would just like, it was a race to get out of the house. Like, Mary, I love you, but I have to leave. And at a certain point, Jack told me, he's like, you know, we can't keep this cat. We have to find this cat a home. And I knew he was right. And we looked around and we found the kitten, a new home. And the night that we went there, it was a 2-block walk, but it took like 40 minutes because I just kept hearing her in her carrier, and I would just like stop and brace a wall and just like sob for a little while. It was so awful. And then we finally get to this person's house, and it's like on the 4th floor of a building, and we walk in and I immediately become crazy. Like, I'm like, this is the 3rd floor. Are there no screens on that window? There has to be screens on that window. And oh my God, is that a bag of Cheetos? If they eat that kind of food, what are they going to feed her? They should go organic. I just start to go crazy. And the whole time, I see my boyfriend Jack standing watching me the way like the lawyer of a crazy person watches them, like just like as long as we can get through the ruling, you know what I mean? And he's watching me like just terrified, and I didn't tell him though about the DVD that I had made. I reached into my pocket, and right when we were about to leave, I handed the DVD to the new owner of the cat, and I said, I just made a collection of photographs. Photographs of Mare when they said she wouldn't live, because I want you to know how special she is. And I looked at Jack, and he was like, abort, abort, abort. Like, I'd be like, get the fuck out. He takes me and we leave, and you know, we leave her there, and the next few days were horrible. I just like cried all the time. At one point I was like drunk in my underwear again with whiskey, being like, I don't even have a job and I don't have an animal that I formed a connection with. I was just like a crazy person. But over the next few weeks, I actually got out more and I saw friends who I forgot I hadn't even seen, and I did get a job, and I got this awesome job working as an on-camera host for this environmental fund, interviewing bands. They flew me to like Bonnaroo, and they flew me to South by Southwest, and I got to interview the Flaming Lips, and it was so awesome until I got fired 3 months later. Hey, but some beginnings are just false starts, because that next Oscar party, after the one where I showed everyone Rosemary's Baby and they were terrified, I was with my dear friend Cammy, and we were talking, and we were like, you know, we both felt the same way, rudderless, lost, and we were like, you know, let's get into storytelling. And we did. And I've been doing that ever since, and I've been writing the way that I told myself when I was younger I was going to write, and I never did. And, you know, this beginning is kind of going to stick. Not long ago, the owner of the cat sent me this email, and I didn't even know he had my email. I hadn't talked to him in years, and he's like, I just want you to know that Mare is still doing great. They kept the name. They apparently don't know what it really means. And he's like, and I wanted to send you these pictures. And he attached this zip file of all these pictures of her since he's had her. Totally healthy and full grown, lounging around. Still a little like with the genpai on the one side, but doing great, you know? And looking at the pictures, it occurred to me, like, I always thought, like, she was my false start. I was her false start, you know what I mean? Like, I was just like, she was just passing through, going to this awesome place where people could love her without needing, like, an EpiPen, you know what I mean? So I think in the end, you know, I don't think you should feel bad about new beginnings, and maybe you have a lot of false starts, but you should never, ever regret them, especially if you're a deformed little kitten that looks like a puppet from Eraserhead. Thank you.
You can see my pussy. There's my pussy to consider. There'll have to be accommodation for my pussy.
Let's just get our bearings again here. All right? Let's take a moment of reflection to review where we've been. Not just sally forth into the noonday sun without a respectful glance back upon the road we've traveled. We just heard a track by Jeff Barr, little collage there, called Felis Catus. Before that, someone very dear to us, someone who is one of us, who works for the show and for the story studio, David Crabb, with a story we call Meerkat Manor. Before that, a song by Evan Voitis called Feel Me, and this is Sean Lee behind me now. Next up, my good friend Beowulf Jones. He's a Los Angelian now, and it's a trip to hear him unleash himself on an audience out there, a brand new audience. The theme at our show in Los Angeles that night was fun. And so we call this one from Mr. Jones, Oh, What Fun.
It's strange to say, but I don't really have fun anymore. I used to. It's like the universe allotted me X amount of fun days, and those days were good, debaucherous fun. But that contract has expired now, and I'm very, very bored. Because I used to party. I partied hard. But the party's over now. And the craziest shit that I get into these days is I am going to watch 6 episodes of Buffy in a row, and when I am done, pizza for breakfast. The only kind of like fun or fulfillment that I get these days is relating to other people. And even that's a catastrophe because I do not relate well with others. My friend Mike was over and he was referring to a Facebook photo that had been uploaded. And he said, hey man, you look so happy in that picture. And because I'm insane, I instantly got defensive. And I was like, happy? What makes you think I was happy? I was what, smiling? Because I know how to smile. If you put a camera in front of me, I'm going to smile. And it doesn't mean it's like, no, it wasn't that. It's just, there was something on your face. You just looked like you're having so much fun. And I said, I'll be the judge of that, thank you very much. Show me the damn picture. I'll believe it when I see it. So he shows me the picture, and sure enough, it was from within the last year, and I had the most fun I've ever had in my life that night. I was in a play. It was called Emancipatory Politics, a Romantic Tragedy, EPART for short. It was this abstract, socio-political, neo-surrealistic, monologue-y, filled with stunning modern dance choreography. It was written and directed by my good buddy, Eric. And Eric is a brilliant writer, a much better writer than me. It's a shame he is not here tonight, because I think if he was here talking to you, we would all be having a lot of fun. Now, one thing Eric and I have in common is that we both love Belle and Sebastian. Now, don't get me wrong. Eric and I, we are men. We are strong, passionate, creatively driven men with fires in our belly. But deep down, I think we would both be much happier just dancing in a corner somewhere by ourselves, silently crying. And that is why we love Belle and Sebastian. So my favorite, or one of my top 3 favorite Belle and Sebastian songs is called Dress Up in You. And I put it on a CD mix for his birthday. And I said, you have got to listen to this song. And he said, I can't wait. I'll get to it next week. And I said, no. You have to listen to it now. This is your new favorite song. And he said, I'm so busy. We've got the play opening. And there's just a million things on my plate. And I said, no, this is your new favorite song. You listen to your favorite song. And he said, I'm not listening to the song. And I said, listen to the song. And he said, I'm not listening to the song. This conversation is over. Goodbye. So I got to the theater that night. And I was up in the seats. when the house opened, and the first thing I heard over the PA was the organ from the beginning of Dress Up in You. And I whipped around, and Eric is standing on the stage, beaming up at me. Now, we didn't have to say anything. I knew he felt exactly the same things about the song that I did. So we just looked at each other, and we started bellowing with laughter. And it was profound. It was so profound, I can't even describe it, which is why I wish Eric was here, because he is a better writer than me. And I think if he was here talking, we would all have a lot of fun. So I said to Mike, laughing with Eric about that song is the most fun I've ever had in my life. And he was skeptical. I don't know exactly what he said, but it was something to the extent of, you know, I can see if Eric and you had scaled Everest together and then you had that exchange where it'd be meaningful. And I was like, okay, I have got to put this in terms he can understand. So I said, Mike, what you are failing to take into consideration is that these days I have very little to live for. And he didn't relate, because I am not good at relating with people. I guess I just draw from different experiences than other people do. Like for me, a conversation piece. You know how when you've been doing meth for 4 days and your body is just this one giant hive and you're pouring with sweat and your eyes are all fucked up and everything's fragmented and you think that you're seeing bugs on the wall, and then you get to the wall and the bug that you think you're hallucinating is actually one of those silver fish or whatever they call it. That was the lowest moment of my life, and I started laughing like hell because I thought it was funny. And these are the experiences that I bring to the table. But as I said, I don't do that anymore. I quit that stuff for a girl, and I didn't have to go to rehab or anything like that. I just did it because I am very good at depriving myself of the things that I love. But I thought I have been in love twice, in two loving relationships. One of those relationships I was using, the other I was not. It was the one where I stopped. So I'll let you decide which relationship was more fun and which was a better relationship. The first one... her name was Stacy, and for the one or two of you who have heard me on this podcast before, this is a different Stacy than I was talking about last time. I just happen to know a lot of Stacys. Now, Stacy... I would have married her if she'd let me. I would have, and I've never felt that way about anyone since, or I don't know if I, she was just everything that I'd want. Granted, all I had ever really wanted was someone I could talk to that would get where I was coming from, preferably in the form of a good-looking woman who digs cool music. And she was, and things were just so new back then, because I was young, and I wasn't living at home anymore, and that was new. And I was in a bunch of bands, and I was skinny, and I looked good, and I had an entire wardrobe based on the cover of the third Velvet Underground album. And I'm not gonna lie, a big part of our relationship was based on powder. And I remember one night I was over there and I was playing her one of the thousands of mixtapes I made her, and I was chopping up a bunch of lines, and she pounces on me. I didn't see it coming. She just sat on my lap and she just plinked right in like a puzzle piece, and her legs went over this way and she wrapped her arms around my neck and she kissed me, and then she drew her head back and just beamed at me with her eyes, and she said, "I just want you to know that I am so glad you're here." And then she got up and she walked back to the couch. That was the message that she wanted to deliver. And it went through me, because I had never experienced passion like that before. And instead of being, you know, this is a victory, I got vulnerable. And I stood up and I tottered over to her. And I said, "You're not going anywhere, right? Because this is perfect, and I'm scared, because nothing for me has ever been perfect, and I don't see why it should start being perfect now. Because I know I don't even know you well enough to love you, but what I know of you, I do love, and I just want to make sure that nothing... And she comes over, and she wraps her arms around me tight, and she tells me every reassuring thing that you would want to hear in that scenario. And do you know what it's like to pine for someone while you're actually holding them? Because with even all the drugs we were on, it didn't ring true. I mean, I pretended it did. I knew it was already broken. Maybe not tonight, maybe not next month, maybe not next year, but this relationship was doomed because it was about the past. We didn't see eye to eye on things. Her favorite thing in the world was poetry, and I hate poetry. To me, the only thing dumber than poetry is burlesque. Flash forward 10 years. Now I'm with Nikki, and this relationship's different. It's an adult relationship, and it's not that fun. There's work. Like, there's heavy lifting. Like, there's compromises. And we were, one night, we were in the middle of our favorite argument for the millionth time. It was the argument about levels, i.e. levels in a relationship. At this level, we should be going out with other couples. And at this level, we should be vacationing together, but not with our families, because that doesn't count. Real vacations. And then there's the level of contributions. I contribute this, you're contributing this. And she just kept, like, tapping at me. And everything she said, it was true. Have you ever been confronted with the truth before? It sucks. I do not want a mirror held up to me because I do not want to know what I look like. But she just kept going. And she's just like, bah, 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 bah. And finally, and I was wrong. I know I was wrong, and I have apologized for it, and I'll apologize for it again right now. But I got mad, and I said, what I have done, what I have given up, and what I have sacrificed for this relationship, what you've done, it doesn't even compare. It doesn't even begin to compare. And she didn't miss a beat. She said, why? Because you stopped shoving shit up your nose? And I said, yes. Because I gave up the thing that I enjoyed that made me feel good about me. And I did it for what? For love? What a Pyrrhic fucking victory that is. You wanted me to save my life? Well, I saved it. And I'm bored now. And as an added bonus, I am going to resent you for the rest of my life because you put me in this position. And I know that's not fair. I know that's not fair, and I hate myself for feeling it, but I can't help the things that I feel. I just feel them. Do you know why they call it partying? Because it's a fucking party. You feel good. You feel alive. You feel invigorated. And I don't have that anymore. Every day is just a fucking malaise. It's the same thing. Every morning I wake up and I go, ugh, this again. And I get it. I get it that some people aren't meant to be happy. And I get that I am one of those people, but I still want to be nice. So I go around and I'm nice to everybody I know. But do you have any idea of the bile, the venom, the anger, the hatred that you have to process in order to pretend to be that nice all the time? Do you have any idea what I'm talking about? Of course you don't, because I do not relate well to other people. So when I say laughing with Eric about that Belle and Sebastian song is the most fun I've ever had, it's the truth. And if you're lucky enough to know someone where you don't even have to speak, you can just look at them and know exactly what they're talking about, well then laugh it up, because that's as good as it fucking gets. I'm done. Clap.
Beowulf Jones, everyone. Not doing cocaine anymore, by the way. What was that like? Holy shit.
Well, this is just a simple song to say what you've done. I told you about and the way they did run. You sure must be strong, and you feel like an ocean made warm by the sun.
Okay, that's all she wrote, gang. This is, of course, the latest from the Shins, Buy Me Now. Don't forget our unbeatable deal with AdamandEve.com. Now, you know you need condoms and lube at the very least. Might as well throw in something to shove up the old wazoo. That way you can save your vegetables for the casserole. Go to adamandeve.com. Type in the offer code RISK at the checkout. You get 50% off just about any item, 3 free adult DVDs, free shipping, and an extra surprise. What's the offer code? RISK. Please review us on iTunes. Leave your comments there. And help us to get others to review us. We've been asking fans to tweet to Rolling Stone, at Rolling Stone, to Entertainment Weekly, at EW, and to the New York Times, at NYT_arts. Tell them they can find us at risk-show.com and use the hashtag ReviewRisk. On Facebook and Twitter, we are at Risk Show. In our shop at risk-show.com, you will find our all-star episodes with Sarah Silverman, Mark Maron, Kevin Nealon, Nick Swardson, Lisa Lampanelli, Samantha Bee, Michael Ian Black, Paul F. Tompkins, and more. Now, don't forget we are an indie podcast. We rely on the help of our fans to keep all this going. So if you go to risk-show.com and scroll down on the right-hand side, see a little guy filling a gas tank. It says, "Keep Risk Running." That's where you can donate to us. Help us out. What else can you do? You can pitch us stories. Tips are at the submissions page at risk-show.com. Finally, learn all about our workshops on storytelling, advanced storytelling, storytelling performance, and storytelling for your team or your career at thestorystudio.org. Folks, today's the day. Take a risk. Penises and buttholes, penises and buttholes, penises and buttholes.